From the author of Putin's Wars comes an essential new military history of Russia from its beginnings to today.
Mark Galeotti, a leading scholar of Russian security affairs,
delivers a masterful history of how war and insecurity has driven Russia's destiny for centuries, including the disastrous invasion of Ukraine. This is the book you need to understand Putin's grip on power in the East, the war in Ukraine, and Russia's future on the global stage.
Forged in War is out now from Osprey Publishing. Order your copy wherever books are sold.
Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation. I'm Didi Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. And in this, our final edition of See How They Run, I am both delighted and taking some consolation from being joined by two of our national political correspondents, John Nichols from the great state of Wisconsin, and Jeet Heer, who is from everywhere. And I guess the first question I have for each of you, and we'll start with Jeet, is how are you feeling this morning?
I'm actually not feeling that bad. I mean, like, obviously, you know, second Trump victory is not what I wanted. But within the, you know, ashes of defeat, defeat is a great teacher. And I think there's some valuable lessons that will be learned here. And more to the point, I do actually also think that there are some real embers of hope, particularly in the places where even if the Democrats lost, they lost by less, or some Democrats there lost by less than the overall trend was. And I think there's actual reason to be hopeful. I mean, it's going to be a long, tough fight for the next a few years. But I actually think the immediate shock of the election should not dissuade us from, like, noticing two big kind of facts. I mean, Trump did get a majority, but I think that size of that majority is a bit overstated. We actually haven't had all the counting, especially in the West Coast states. And I'm thinking that we're looking more like at a between 1-2% majority rather than the sort of 4-5% that people were talking about on election night. So it's a kind of narrow popular majority. And within that, I think there's a lot of room to kind of rebuild and to win back, especially since if the, we'll talk about it more, but I mean, if my analysis is that this is a part of a persistent pattern of popular anger at the system in the United States, then I actually think that the very forces that allowed Trump to win this time can be harnessed by people that are much have much better politics than Trump in future elections.
Okay, well, speaking of rays of light and optimism, John Nichols, how are you? And tell us why.
Well, I am conscious of the fact that people are going to process this in a lot of different ways, and respectful of the fact that there are people who are really scared and really hurting right now. And I have a great respect for that. I'm a little bit lucky. I am speaking to you about a half hour after going to the victory event for Senator Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, in my home state of Wisconsin. And Tammy Baldwin, running as who she has always been, an out lesbian, the first LGBTQ person elected to Congress as an out candidate, not somebody who got in and then came out, as a woman, as a progressive on most issues, who sided with Bernie Sanders on, you know, expanding Medicare and healthcare issues, et cetera, won. And she won with a campaign that was distinct from what you saw nationally. Her ads featured Teamsters talking about how Senator Baldwin helped them restore their pensions, and shipbuilders talking about how she got contracts for small ports in Wisconsin. It was a deeply working class oriented campaign that, frankly, did a lot of the things I wish the national campaign had done more of. And I'll note that she never appeared with Liz Cheney. And so while I share all the sadness about the 2024 campaign's ultimate result in the presidential race. I do like see rays of light, and one of them I was just with. I was in a hall of union members wearing their T-shirts from all their different unions. And when Tammy Baldwin walked in, despite all the tough things that have happened, they were able to rise to their feet and cheer on a victory. So, again, I guess that's the mix of things that we do, Don. We recognize the horror, but then in the midst of that, we try to find some of those rays of light. The Baldwin victory was a ray of light. So, too, was the Slotkin victory in Michigan. I don't agree with Slotkin on a lot of issues. In fact, I actually have some real differences with her on some foreign policy stuff. But she, too, ran a working-class, labor-oriented campaign, and she won.
Well, we'll get back to Slotkin in a minute, because I think there's some really interesting material there, which I want to cover. I want to say that this is not the broadcast I was hoping to have. I was hoping we were going to be talking about how Harris won and how the Democratic Party's theory of the case, which frankly I never believed, proved to be correct. I would have been much happier eating crow this morning. And I suppose the only reason, you know, I take no pleasure in the fact that their theory of the case proved wrong, but there is some relief, I suppose, in realizing that the worst has just happened and that you're still here. And we're all still here.
Trump. I know. I want to like echo that, just because, I mean, this is something I think I've said on previous podcasts and certainly have written about, which is like there's a, you know, Harris's fundamental strategy, which to caricature just only slightly, was basically rerun the Hillary Clinton 2016 campaign, but like with a, you know, better, more, or at least more popular candidate. I always thought that was a kind of mistake. I thought, like, you know, especially this sort of embrace of Never Trump Republicans of Liz Cheney and making, you know, Mark Cuban, you know, former Republican billionaire, one of your main surrogates. I thought that that was a mistake, and I thought it could end very badly. But I also thought, as the election was happening, I said, well, I hope I'm wrong. I hope that, like, you know, they have either better information or a better sense of where the politics are. And I hope that their, you know, theory wins. And then I will, you know, spend this last podcast saying, like, I was wrong. I that, you know, you got to hand it to them. I take no satisfaction in saying that, like, you know, like what I feared, which was that an embrace of, you know, the discredited neoconservative wing of the Republican Party will actually not get you any significant number of votes where you need them, and B, will actually demobilize and demoralize your own voters. I mean, that's what seems to have happened.
Well, if I can just jump in on one thing that you said there, which is they never have better information.
No.
It's a lesson we have to learn. I'm in the same camp as you, yeah. Right? Hillary Clinton in 2016 said, oh, we got data that tells us what's going to happen. Their data was useless. And and this time around, there was an assumption that they kind of had a plan, an arc, a strategy. Some aspects of that strategy were great. Focusing on abortion rights was important, and it did mobilize people in that. And focusing on to the extent that they did on a care economy and building that out, that also reached people. There's no question. We saw evidence of that in some of it. But let's be absolutely clear. What the nation talked about through this season, and I take no pleasure in this except that I appreciate the nation, was generally right. The nation said you have to deal with the issue of Gaza. If you do not get a better stance on that, that is going to hurt you. I think it did. The nation said, and I wrote about this a lot, you have to talk about economic issues at a fundamental level. And they simply didn't. And so I think we have to get over the habit of thinking that this professional class of campaign managers that literally jump from places to place, you know, from campaign to campaign, that they always know what to do. I had somebody last week, I was talking about problems with strategy, on the what I thought of as problems with strategy on the Harris campaign, as regards, you know, especially union issues, trade, things like that. And the person said, well, you think you know more than David Plouffe? And I was like, you know, we're going to find out.
Well, I think we did find out.
Now we know. No, I mean, let us enter the recriminations and reckoning portion of this podcast, which I know we're all eager to get into. So their theory of the case, as you've both recapped it, essentially was don't talk about Gaza. Don't scare the horses. And by horses, I mean big Democratic Party donors on the economy. Talk always about character whenever you can and assume that abortion is going to come to the rescue. And first of all, abortion did not come to the rescue. One of the statistics that struck me this morning looking through the exit polls was, and also the results, was that in Florida, 57% of voters voted in favor of enshrining the right to abortion in the state constitution. Sadly, in Florida, they needed a supermajority of 60% to get it into the constitution, but still 57% of Florida voters voted for it. And then Donald Trump carried Florida by an even bigger margin. So, you know, the Democratic consultant class and or the identitarian politicians who were telling us that abortion was going to be the magic bullet for Democrats in 2024, in the same way that it theoretically had broken the red wave in 2022, turned out not to be right.
Yeah, no, that's something. I mean, we'll probably need more data to like really figure out like what exactly happened. But it is a case of what we're seeing now from exit polls is that in 2022, pro-choice voters, where they're like the vast majority of Americans, you know, supported the Democratic candidates something like 70% of the time. Whereas this time, it actually seems like people identified as pro-choice, it was like closer to 50-50.
I'm not sure it was 50-50, but
it was much tighter. I should also say, you know, like exit polling is always like super dubious, and we're actually gonna have to wait for the next 6 months until Pew and others have like really like, you know, accurate voter file data. But I mean, it does seem like that the and I think that the reason for the difference was that in 2022, Democrats, you know, running as in midterms, were able to pin the abortion label on the Republicans. And this time, you know, Trump was able to, I think, A, use his reputation as, you know, a famously kind of libertine person with not a really, nobody would call him pious or evangelical. Combine that with saying it's a state's issue, I'm not going to touch abortion, that like seems to have won over enough pro-choice people to, you know, like think that they're not going to make this like their priority in voting on a federal level, on a presidential level. I mean, it's a real problem. They have to figure that out, how to be able to pin the abortion on a presidential candidate.
So what I would say only on that is that we know exactly what they did. Right. And we know kind of exactly what happened here. Politics is evolutionary. We're not stationary. And so in 2022, they got their teeth handed to them on an issue that they were wrong on. And they also knew that where they were at was deeply unpopular. So they meticulously figured out a way to talk about it. Right. And this is the truth in politics always. You know, too often Democrats keep talking about an issue the way they talked about it in a cycle they did well in. The Republicans sit there and say, okay, yeah, that issue was a problem for us. How are we going to talk about it in this cycle? What are we going to do? And you're exactly right, Jeet. Donald Trump came up with this whole thing about, oh yeah, we did what everybody wanted. We sent it back to the states, right? Now, we heard that as, you know, bogus and you know, a lie in a whole bunch of ways. But voters, I think a significant number of voters heard him saying, oh yeah, I'm kind of, you know, I'm up for whatever you're up for. If you want to do this, that's great. If you don't, it actually ended up being a very smart strategy for the position he is in, right? He's saying to the anti-choice voters, you can get what you want. And he was saying to the pro-choice voters, well, I'm not as big a problem as you think. And then also I would tell you in the Senate races, it was fascinating to watch because in the Senate races, you saw all sorts of advertising and messaging that was saying, literally saying, well, we all think that there should be protections for pre-existing conditions and stuff like that, blah, blah, blah. But this Democratic Senate candidate is really extreme. And then they went to all their blah, blah, blahs. And they ended up in a situation where they succeeded for, you know, kind of voters who are not so frequent voters, right? Voters who come probably for a presidential election. When they tune in, when they got the information that they got was that, you know, in all the advertising speeches, comments, Republicans are kind of reasonable on this, right? You know, they're you know, maybe I don't agree with them, but they're kind of reasonable. That then, I think, took the issue for a portion of voters, and it moved it over to a place where they're still pro-choice, right? But, and they would vote pro-choice on a referendum, but they didn't see it as the top issue for the presidential race. And the last thing I'll say on that is that Democrats in that situation needed to recognize they were going to get the votes of ardently pro-choice voters, right? But there was going to potentially be a slippage among folks who are a little more casual. They thought that they could deal with that with, you know, further emphasis on the issue, and that was good. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But they also, I think they thought that they could deal with that by doing suburban events with Liz Cheney, right? And again, there's no intersection. Liz Cheney is an anti-choice extremist. But they were out there saying, oh, we'll reach out to suburban women.
John, I think there is an intersection that you're not naming. And I also think that things are worse than you said. You know, you said Democrats send out candidates, they send out a position based on the last time they did well in a cycle, and they try to recapitulate that. But in fact, in this campaign, they sent Bill Clinton to Michigan. So they sent a candidate the last time they did really badly in a cycle. They sent Bill Clinton to one of the three states where he was most likely to get lynched. And then he came and he on NAFTA. I mean, we're talking about Mr. NAFTA in the state, you know, the one of the most union heavy states in the country, one of the most anti free trade states in the country. You get the mouthpiece for free trade. And then he, just to double down on it, he decides to lecture Arab voters on the historic claim to Judea and Samaria by Israel. I mean, you really couldn't make this up. You know, there was.
And you know, this is one thing that I think is we had a piece in The Nation, a big piece, interviewing Sean Fain from the UAW, a week or so out from the election, saying, look, here's how to win the blue wall states, right? These are historic industrial states, and here's how even to do a little bit better in Ohio and some other places. Identify Trump's reform of NAFTA, which failed, which was a disaster, as Trump's NAFTA. Take the term that everyone knows and just talk about it. And the fact is that Kamala Harris herself actually did take it into one speech, right, in Michigan. But it wasn't taken out on the road. It didn't become central to the message. And then it's undone by appearances with militant free traders like Cheney, like the Cheneys, like, you know, Adam Clinton out there for you, stuff like that. And so they never owned that issue. And the fact of the matter is, here's the amazing thing about it, the really striking thing about it. Only a handful of senators voted against Trump's NAFTA. Bernie Sanders, of course, a couple other very progressive folks, and Kamala Harris. She actually voted the right way. She could have gone on the trail in the three states that she needed, right? Vitally needed. She could have gone on the trail and said, I understand these issues so well that I voted against Trump's NAFTA, right? It would have been wonderful, great messaging, and Trump would have been, you know, Trump would have responded. You know, Trump would have said something, and you would have opened up a debate on something where Harris could have come out ahead.
Well, I mean, I think it's worth sort of stepping back a little bit about like why Harris did not pursue some of the more populist messaging that, you know, we all agree would have worked better. Because I actually think like we have to have a go back a little bit longer in history. I think the original sin, you know, one could actually go back to 2016. Maybe the original sin was to tell Joe Biden not to run and to try to clear the field for Hillary Clinton. But after that, the original sin was Joe Biden's decision in 2022, 2023, that he will run again, despite the fact that he was running like as a very old candidate and a very frail visibly frail candidate with who was already like having huge favorability issues and was actually doing very badly. Like if he had said, you know, like I've done my historical task of defeating Trump. Now, as I had promised, I will be a bridge to the future. Let's have a primary. You would have had an actual primary. You'd have had all the issues that Democratic voters care about, including Gaza, like fought out in a primary. And you would have had a candidate, which could have been Kamala Harris or could have been someone else, who would then be able to say coherently, like, you know, thank you, Joe, for 2020. Thank you for all that you've done. But I'm a different candidate. I stand for different things. And I am change. And I am the future. That did not happen. But Biden stayed on. He had the first disastrous debate. And then there was a sort of scramble to see who could replace him. And the only logical option, although I guess there's some talk of a mini primary, but that didn't pan out, but it was Kamala Harris. And she had two problems. One of which is like she was not able to distance herself from Biden, from, you know, just the path that she had taken to becoming the nominee. Maybe also because Biden made that as a condition of
her being. You reject conditions, won't you?
Yeah, or it could well be. In any case, she did not. She ran as a Joe Biden. As I, you know, she was literally asked, what will you do differently than Biden? And she first said, you know, like nothing. And then she was asked a bit more. And she said, oh, I'll appoint a Republican to my cabinet. So saying the only difference with me and Joe Biden is I'll be more conservative than Joe Biden. No, but I think it's not just the why she took this. Like initially, once she was the nominee, there's a huge burst of enthusiasm for her, especially she picked Walz. But then she needed money. Joe Biden had, you know, like was not bringing in money when he was the nominee. They were deeply in the hole. She needed the donor class. They chose not to go with a small donor strategy as their main thing, although they were doing very well with small donors. They decided to bring in money and they hooked up with people like Tony West, who like really tied them, a donor class that tied them to a corporate, not just a corporate, but a donor class agenda, which included, you know, like not challenging Joe Biden, included not promising any changes on Israel, Gaza, and included having Mark Cuban, you know, like this Republican billionaire as one of her main surrogates. And Cuban went out and started talking about things like saying like, well, when Democrats talk about taxing capital gains, they don't really mean that. And then like undercutting the actual progressive policies that they had. And then you had donors leaking like crazy that they want to get rid of Lina Khan and other progressives that Joe Biden had appointed. So you got the impression that like this was a candidate at that stage who seemed A, more beholden to the donor class than Biden had been, and B, promising, especially through surrogates like Cuban, a more conservative policy stance. And then also thinking they could make up for any loss and erosion in the base by getting Republican women. And that meant like, you know, doing the bear hug of Liz Cheney. So, I mean, it's just like the position that they chose. These were all choices that were made and they fed into this disaster.
Well, I think it's worth also pointing out the depths of the failure of their theory of the case in that if you look at the exit polls, and I realize that exit polls are not an exact science, far from it, but it looks like at most Harris Walz got 5% of registered Republican voters.
They actually did worse.
Possibly, yeah, worse than Biden in 2020. Yeah,
they did worse than Biden among conservatives.
And Trump did much better in getting Democratic voters. You know, it was as if Trump had gone campaigning with Bernie Sanders and she'd gone campaigning with the Cheneys.
So let's take a few of these things apart, right? Let's start to really look seriously at it. First and foremost, the only place where I would maybe differ a little with Jeet's assessment is that, you know, somehow at some point they hooked up with the donor class. The donor class was always there. And the donor class, let me put it this way. If Harris had distinguished herself some way as vice president, as somebody who's really at odds with the donor class, the handoff would have been very different if it had happened at all, right? Because the donor class is dominant within the Democratic Party. So that's the first thing to understand. And I think that obviously we've established this outreach to Republicans didn't work, right? Weirdly enough, the work of unions was successful. They actually, among working class people, among union members, right? People, self-identified union members, they slightly went up from Biden. They actually did yeoman's work and it succeeded. The problem was that that message wasn't expanded beyond internal education within the unions. And so the fact is that Jeet's point is exactly right. The donor class came in. They said, well, this is the kind of campaign we run, right? If they had simply farmed the campaign out to the UAW and painters unions messaging shops, which are both excellent, by the way, those folks would have known how to win the states, right? And they would have expanded the message beyond the union hall out to a broader message to working class folks. It would have worked. That's the bottom line. But one other thing I would suggest to you that is important to understand in this context, I do think we have to talk about whether Tim Walz was the right vice presidential candidate. And a lot of us really liked Walz, right, as he was coming up. He was, he seemed fun, he seemed lively, he had that great appearance on MSNBC where he said, you know, the Republicans are just weird, and everybody's like, wow, that's a great way to talk to him about him. And I'll admit, I was one of those people who thought, you know, well, Walz is superior to a lot of the other prospects. The fact of the matter is that Saturday Night Live may have summed it up. They may have summed it up where they had the routine where Tim Kaine came out, their 2016 candidate, and they asked the panel in some game show variation, who is this, right? And the host goes, well, you voted for him in 2016. Who is that? And the person, everybody's like, oh, I can't remember, blah, blah, blah. And the, finally they said who it was. And he says, well, you know, he's just not dynamic like Tim Walz. And then they put a picture of Tim Walz up next to a picture of Tim Kaine. They looked identical. And the fact of the matter is that I'm not here to beat up on Tim Walz. I liked him a lot. I still think he's a really, you know, nice guy and stuff like that. But I'm not sure that was the right choice for the ticket. And I think the fact that they underperformed in Minnesota, they underperformed in Western Wisconsin, which is essentially the Minnesota media markets. There is some evidence to suggest that that VP pick may not have worked.
Well, I think it didn't work in the end, but I want to take a little bit of issue with your account of it.
I love that because I'm not sure I'm right. I want to hear people saying what they say.
This is audio. So our listeners don't know necessarily, despite your universal fame, that you are a white guy with white hair, dumping on two white guys with white hair. I don't think that Josh Shapiro, the fact that he has dark hair, would have made that much difference to the ticket. I think the problems are actually structural. And I think that the thing is, the reason we liked Tim Walz when he was chosen, aside from his personal affability, is because it seemed to signal a sharp break from previous practice and a determination to run an economically populist campaign. And I think that's the problem. The problem was not that they picked him. The problem was that they didn't run the campaign that would have used him. And at the same time, you know, I will take credit for being one of the few commentators on the left who thought that J.D. Vance was a dangerous pick in the sense that he was going to be a missile aimed at Midwestern voters. And that is indeed what he proved to be. You know, he had a bad first week and everybody said, oh, I can't believe the stupidity. Trump is already trying to get rid of him. But in fact, he went out there into the manosphere and he really did his thing on podcasts, on, you know, lots of places that you and I might regard as fringe venues. But he certainly brought their margins up in states that they were going to win anyway. And I think he probably helped them in sub-Midwestern states.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think it goes to the cautious campaign, which is an adventurous one. That's to say, I think Walz might have worked if they had really, you know, doubled down on the populist message. I also seem to remember there was a period after the convention where, like, they were doing a lot less media. That included Walz, and people were kind of wondering, what's going on here? Like, Walz is great on TV. Why is he not on TV anymore? There seemed to be a period where they were kind of, you know, trying to tap down on Walz, which is, I think, in keeping with the general thrust of the campaign, which is like they ran a very safe campaign, kind of a campaign that you would run if you're the ahead and, you know, want to preserve. But, you know, like, it was always a close campaign. And, you know, given the, you know, unpopularity of Joe Biden and the sort of anti-incumbent feeling, they should have run as an underdog campaign. If you're underdog, you take risks and you do, like, you know, things that you might not otherwise do. And I think that's tied with the other point you made, which is about media strategy, which is, I think we have to see that Trump and Vance had, like, a, you know, real strategy. You go where people are. And people aren't, like, the gettable voters are not the ones who are watching, reading the New York Times, are listening to NPR, traditional media. You know, there are people who are, like listening to Joe Rogan or listening to any number of weird, strange podcasts about UFOs, say. And you go on, these outlets, and that's where you find the voters. And I think that the... the two kind of the Democrats are very reluctant to do, like, unconventional media. They did some podcasts, but they tend to be more kind of even, like, you know, podcasts that are more mainstream within sphere.
I think, though, that the Democrats, this is one thing. I think that Democrats got thrown off at a critical stage. And it was because when Harris came in, and I'll be interested in what you guys think about this. When Harris came in, there was such relief and just such a kind of burst of enthusiasm. And she came in well. She came in, you know, communicating well, and it just looked like things were turning in a very different direction. And I think what people, what Democrats failed to understand was they were so deep in the hole at that point. And like literally the week before Harris stepped up, they were starting to look at New Jersey as a battleground state, right? I mean, it was, their numbers were going down, down, down. New Mexico, they were concerned. And Democratic senators were concerned they were going to lose in places like New Mexico because Biden was going down so far. Harris comes in, there's this burst of enthusiasm. And I think what happened was that they all looked at the polls. The polls actually took them back up into a very competitive spot. And my sense is that there was an assumption that it would keep going, right? That once you restored the loss and got back to the baseline, that you'd keep, that Harris would keep growing her support, that it would keep expanding. And I think that's where they went to that cautious campaign. They felt like, well, we've got the winner here.
I think that's right. I think they ran, I mean, Jeet wrote about this several times, that they ran a protect the lead campaign without actually ever really having a lead to protect.
No. They protect the lead and also, like, not willing to think, as an adventurous campaign does, like, where are we weak? What are people unhappy with? And then that's why I think the Gaza stuff is, like, very relevant. And it actually is turning out to be the case that in the Midwestern battleground states, the actual gap between Harris and Trump is actually very narrow. And is narrower in Michigan than the uncommitted vote. And is narrower than, you know, like, what they lost among Arabs. And they actually did. I mean, you don't send Richie Torres and Bill Clinton to Michigan to, like, spout, like, not just like a Zionist point, a labor Zionist or liberal Zionist point, but actual what I would call settler talking points about the Bible giving Judea and Samaria to the Jews. Like, that is actually, like, you know, what the followers of Rabbi Meir Kahan talk about. You do not do that unless you have, like, decided, you know, we're so comfortably ahead, we can actually do a sister soldier moment and tell these voters, you know, like, they can go to hell, we don't need you. And what are you going
to
do?
I have a two-word counter-argument to that, because I would like that to be right. I mean, I would not want Arab American voters to be blamed for this loss. I think the blame for this loss rests firmly with Joe Biden for staying in too long, squashing primaries, and then with the Democratic corporate establishment for running a cautious and tone-deaf campaign. But in Michigan, Elise Slotkin won re-election comfortably. So how salient really was Gaza in Michigan when someone who is firmly...
I can answer that question.
Okay.
Slotkin wasn't great on the issue, right?
It's not that she wasn't great. She was identical to Harris and Biden.
So here's the thing. Gaza, for better or worse, became identified as a presidential issue. And it was the issue that people are looking at the presidential race, thought, okay, you know, this is going to be, you know, I'm concerned about it. This is going to influence how I vote. Whereas in down ballot races and even in the Senate race, I don't think it was the same thing. I don't think it had that same resonance, because so much of the debate had been focused on Biden and on whether Harris would allow a Palestinian American to speak at the convention, things like that, which was a terrible forced error. And so my sense is that's the answer, Don, is that this issue skewed very presidential. You didn't see it playing as much in congressional races or the Senate races. Not that it shouldn't have, mind you. But I don't think you saw it. I think you saw it playing at that presidential level. And here's an interesting thing. You talk about Michigan. I think that is, there's something thing to look at there, but that is a media angle that we have to be very careful about, because Gaza was also a huge deal with students, with young people. And if you look at Wisconsin, where I live, and if you look at several other battleground states, which have a lot of college campuses, what you saw was underperformance.
Yes,
on many college campuses.
Yeah.
And you also saw a bizarre overperformance for Trump in some of them, right? That Trump actually did better than expected. And in both of those cases, I don't think it's always Gaza's the explanation. I think some of Trump's, you know, some of the other things that Trump did were a factor. But I don't think you can underestimate Gaza. And when you're talking in a state like Wisconsin with a 30,000 Trump victory of around 30,000 votes, I do think it had an impact. I think also the other thing to look at is, one last thing on this issue, is that it became a drama in the presidential race. And that was, you know, Harris actually said a few things at the convention that suggested she might be open to giving a little bit of space, right? And then people were like, okay, let's see some evidence of this. Well, the first evidence would have been to have a Palestinian speaker at the convention, which would have done them no harm and would have actually, I think, helped a great deal. The next evidence would be to continue to talk about Gaza on the campaign trail. Yes, it's a challenging issue, but having rallies where it's not a part of the speech when there are so many people that want to hear something, right? Even a bit of deference and a bit of respect. And I just think that just made the issue actually more salient for people that worried about it as regards to presidential than it did for congressional races and Senate races. I'll also do one last line I'll just throw here, that Rashida Tlaib in Detroit, who pointedly did not endorse, right? She basically said, I want to beat Trump, but you know, she didn't say anything about endorsing. She swept to victory. Her numbers were huge. And so too were the numbers of an awfully lot of other Democrats who were outspoken on Gaza and who were clear on it. They didn't suffer any slippage of their vote. I know there were a couple of primaries that we looked at, but there are a lot of unique factors there. When you get into this November competition, and when you look at races where people actually had a relatively serious opponent, like a Summer Lee, she had to work in her race, they won. And so there's just such a lesson for Democrats here that being open to a better stance on Gaza, to one that actually is about trying to end this thing and breaking with Biden on this, I genuinely believe would have been helpful. I think it would have made a big difference.
Yeah, and I think the other factor that we're leaving out and why it was a presidential issue was Trump's own behavior on this, which you know I did a column on. And there was a New York Times article, which is very interesting, which said that the Trump campaign's research showed that in the battleground states, something like six times, a very large percentage of persuadable voters, for them, their main concern was Israel-Gaza. And this is why in the last few weeks of the election, you started to see Trump, as he did before in 2016, talking like using anti-war rhetoric. And in 2016, Hillary Clinton, one of her taglines on Donald Trump was that he's going to be too even-handed on Israel-Palestine and and not concerned enough with Israeli security. Now, obviously, you know, like as an actual president, Trump was terrible. You know, did the Abraham Accords. It was a warmonger, but he really played when he runs for election. Trump knows that the United States in the 21st century, after, you know, the forever wars, is a country weary of war. A country where people do not like the sort of, you know, attempts to maintain American hegemony at the risk of war. And he and Vance both really used a lot of anti-war rhetoric. And Vance himself had, you know, in 2016 had written an article saying that, you know, Trump's anti-war rhetoric is a big part of his appeal to the white working class. And I would say not just the white working class. And Trump went to Michigan and met with Arab Americans there and, you know, like...
appeared on stage with imams.
Yes, appeared. Whereas, as we just discussed, like they would not let a single Palestinian American on stage at the DNC, would not like meet with Palestinian American lawmakers who said they are supporting Kamala Harris. And would not even allow them to make vetted speeches. So I just think, like, if you're like just looking at the contrast, it's a contrast between one campaign that just like has total disdain for its own voters, for people who had voted for them in past elections at 80% or more, versus another campaign that is willing to look out for, willing to make an effort to put out an olive branch, to reach out to voters, to say, I hear you. And there's that famous moment, which was celebrated by this kind of resistance liberals, where Kamala Harris was speaking and there's protesters. And then she said, I'm speaking. And, you know, to cut them off. And there were so many clips of this on social media with liberals saying, like, isn't that great? We have seen such so forceful. And I'm sorry, but if people are protesting an ongoing war, your job as a politician is not to say, I'm speaking. Your job is to listen. And they did not listen. They deliberately said, we were plugging our ears. We will not listen to you. And that was their theory. They tried it out, and we see the consequences.
But we see the consequences, but how do we... You know, how do we, and I don't mean the three of us or even The Nation magazine, how does the left reap these consequences? How do we make sure there is a reckoning?
Well, first and foremost, it's always okay to say, I told you so, right? and Jeet wrote some fine pieces along the way. I hope I wrote a couple of fine pieces along the way that begged them. We're not just talking about this after the election, right? These are things we talked about during the campaign and others too, Joan Walsh and others who highlighted, you know, Nation folks who highlighted things that should be done better. And Ellie Mistal, who focused in on all sorts of, I mean, I think our writers and a lot of people on other publications and a lot of activists, really did try to say, you know, there's better ways to do it. So saying I told you so is not a bad thing, right? That is useful because it means you're not just a Monday morning quarterback, right? You're actually saying that these were things that the campaign knew about and should have done better. With that said, I don't think there's any value in, you know, beating up Kamala Harris. I think Kamala Harris took on a very tough job. She had 107 days to try and, you know, reposition a party that had refused to acknowledge that they had a sitting president who wasn't up for running for re-election. And you know, I think she did many things well. And I think there's some of this habit on the part of people who are casual political commentators. They're like, oh, well, she was the wrong candidate, or she was this, she was that. The party is the problem. The Democratic Party is where the problem is. And I wrote a book that traced the problem to 1944, right? So it's nothing new. And what I would argue is this, that what you do not want to hear is the phrase rebuild the Democratic Party, right? What you need is a conversation about a new Democratic Party. We are stuck with a two-party system. And I favor multi-party democracy. I think it's the way to go. Don, you tweeted about, you know, voting on the working families line, and I think that was important and good. But in this overall, in this process, we were stuck with a two-party system. When we, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, when we talk about the problems of the Democratic Party, we often, we go back to Roosevelt and the New Deal, right? And we say, oh yeah, the Economic Bill of Rights and things like that. These are great. And I agree, they were great, right? But we are so far along in our politics. The Republican Party has evolved so radically and to become such a different party than it ever was. The Democratic Party needs to look at the moment it is in and figure out how to talk about the future in ways that are different often than how they've done it in the past. I've noted in the last couple of days that Bernie Sanders put out a very powerful statement about ignoring the working class, the multiracial, multiethnic working class, not just white voters, you know, or something like that. The multiracial, multiethnic working class. It was a damning statement in many ways about where the Democratic Party is. He's not alone. Union leaders are really stepping up. The head of the Painters Union had a statement out. I'm going to write about it. It was stark. And it said, look, you know, we did our job, but the Democrats did not. And I think that we find this on a bunch of other issues, abortion rights, on immigration, a host of issues. These are issues that are part of our politics. You can't avoid talking about them. You have to figure out how to talk about them. And you have to figure out how to reach out to people where they are at. That is a new Democratic Party. That is not a Democratic Party that dusts off the Hillary Clinton playbook or the Bill Clinton playbook or even perhaps the Barack Obama playbook. It is a party that says, we've got to change. And I use an example, and both of you know it well. In Britain, United Kingdom, after Thatcher was out of office, the Conservative Party there for a long time tried to run Thatcher campaigns, right? Cycle after cycle, they tried to find maybe somebody younger, somebody a little different, but they're still running kind of a Thatcherite campaign. And finally, David Cameron, who I have no affection for, but David Cameron came along and said, oh, no, we're going to be a different party. We're not going to talk about Thatcher so much. We're going to talk about, you know, what we offer people now. And Cameron won, you know, and I do think that in the Democratic Party, what we have to look for is the people who are talking about how it can be a party for now and where we're headed. This, the last thing I'll say is this was a campaign where the impact of artificial intelligence, AI, machine learning, almost all of our technological progress, which is radically transforming every aspect of how we communicate and how we live, was not discussed. I know that Donald Trump doesn't know how to discuss it. I understand that. But the fact that Democrats weren't a party sufficiently of the future to talk to people's anxieties about these changes and to have a vision for how to deal with that, I mean, that's a huge loss. It's like not talking about, you know, all sorts of other vital issues. And so I do think the Democratic Party's got to find a bunch of new people. I know I just mentioned Bernie Sanders, who's obviously an old player. But it's got to find a bunch of new people who are talking about how to position the party in very different ways as a progressive, I would dare say, radical party of the future, rather than one that says, you know, we're not as bad as the Republicans. And, you know, boy, once, you know, 80 years ago, we were really quite good.
We're not as bad as the Republicans, and we love some of the worst Republicans. Yeah. What's your prescription for the future? Because we're almost
There has to be like a radical shakeup of the Democratic Party. But I think John has outlined some of the positive stuff. I mean, there has to be a shakeup, includes like negative stuff. I actually think that the party needs to find ways of actually punishing the people who have, for you know, the second time in 10 years, lost to Donald Trump, and it's many of the same people. It's a small cadre of people in both the donor class and in the Democratic consultant class that have made these mistakes. I think we need to have frank conversations. You know, The Nation magazine can play a part of this. These people need to be named, shamed, and I would say shunned. I mean, if we lived in a society like medieval Japan or Europe, where there's a sense of honor, these people would like join a monastery and never speak again. But that's not what they're doing. What they're going to do,
that would be very refreshing. And I should point out your moderation and not advocating for seppuku. But
yeah, very, very humane.
Well, okay. Yeah, that's the further development of the feudal model. But the, like everyone involved in sort of, you know, Imperial Japan in the 30s who led to disaster, like they abandoned public life after things went really bad.
They respected it had not gone well.
So I actually think there has to be an active effort to like penalize these people and bring in new people. I mean, like, it's partially that you have the same cast of people in. And it's not like there's like a lack of talent. There has to be a sense that there's a class of people in power who have failed the country, have failed the party, and there has to be no pulling of punches on this. And there, and this I think extends to the donor class. That we have to have a real accountability for the donor class of like how. Of course one welcomes their money, but are they actually, you know, limiting the party's ability to win elections? I think the mechanism for this is primary fights. Bernie Sanders, I think, you know, the best thing, you know, aside from his great politics, was the model of primary fighting of the small donor thing, which has sort of gone into abeyance. But I think if you get the right candidates and the right messages, and there's a lot of urgency to these issues, AI, but also climate, Palestine, Gaza, to get that out there. This New York Times reporter, Lydia Palgreen, tweeted something very interesting. And she said, one could argue that the rank and file didn't really get any choice of any nominee in a truly fair and open primary fight since Obama. And it shows. This is not something you normally hear from the mainstream media. But I mean, she's basically saying that 2008 was the last time you had a really open, fair and free primary fight in the Democratic Party. And you got somebody who was not the pick of the party establishment in, and that was Obama.
Well,
and
in fairness, then, Obama was the pick of some of the establishment.
Yeah.
That's
but,
important to remember.
Let
me pivot this for one second and ask Don, you very early on identified Pennsylvania as the place where this was going to come down to, and you said it again and again and again, and you went in there often to figure it out. And so I'm interested as we talk about how to evolve the Democratic Party, I'd love it if you'd talk for just a moment about your experience of frankly, seeing where the problems were, seeing where the challenges were, and what needs to be done.
So I should say I spent the last weekend knocking on doors in Berks County in Reading, Pennsylvania. And I would say I've learned a couple of things. One is that the donor class dependency of the Democratic Party has to be broken. You know, Howard Dean showed how to do this in 2004. This is not a wheel that needs to be invented anew. It's just a path of virtue that we have departed from and we have to return to, because essentially that keeps us from talking, that keeps us, it keeps Democratic candidates from talking about the scale of political change needed to reach voters in the hollowed out, formerly industrial towns in central Pennsylvania that it turns out our elections are won or lost in. Now it's true that the Harris local advertising in those places was good, but it was not the national conversation. And the reason it was not the national conversation is because you can't talk about it if you're relying on billionaires to fund your campaigns. You just can't. So I think that's essential. The other thing, and I think this is counterintuitive for me and maybe for all of us, is I saw some data afterwards that says that the kind of effort I was doing, which is to say parachuting in from Brooklyn to Pennsylvania to knock on people's doors, made me feel better, but actually doesn't do a damn bit of good. And that what does a damn bit of good is a adequately funded, and I know you have this in Wisconsin, John, state party where you are out there every week, not just every 4 years, where you're out there every week, where you're talking to voters, where you have real relationships, where you can do deep canvassing, and where you are able to slowly build the relationships, the peer-to-peer relationships that actually do get people to the polls and may even sway people to vote for your candidate. So I think the two things I would say from this is break the addiction to the donor class, and at the same time, find a way to adequately fund state parties. That's my prescription from the future. For me, Dede Guttenplan, John Nichols, Jeet here, all of us here at The Nation, This has been See How They Run. Thank you all.
Thanks.
From the author of Putin's Wars comes an essential new military history of Russia from its beginnings to today.
Mark Galeotti, a leading scholar of Russian security affairs,
delivers a masterful history of how war and insecurity has driven Russia's destiny for centuries, including the disastrous invasion of Ukraine. This is the book you need to understand Putin's grip on power in the East, the war in Ukraine, and Russia's future on the global stage.
Forged in War is out now from Osprey Publishing. Order your copy wherever books are sold.